Get back to basics with Judaism 101 with Rabbi Michael Katz.
Hi, a very good afternoon to you. Wonderful to be in your company. Great to be here this afternoon. Another beautiful Wednesday afternoon here in the Highveld, here in Joburg. Coming to you live, of course. It's Rabbi Michael Katz on Judaism 101.9. And here we are in the midst of the month of November. And of course, today being the 12th of Cheshvan, commemorates several special dates. And as we always do at the beginning of our show, let's go into some of those for the next few days. First of all, today, the 12th of Cheshvan, is the Yahrzeit of a holy Jew by the name of Reb Zev Wolf Kitzis. He was a close associate, prominent disciple of the Baal Shem Tov. Many a story of the Baal Shem Tov involves Reb Zev Wolf Kitzis. He was a scholar in his own right. He was a man who accompanied his master, the Baal Shem Tov, on many of his travels, and he witnessed many of the miracles and the miraculous accomplishments of the Baal Shem Tov firsthand. It also happens to be, if we fast forward in Jewish history, it happens to be one of the most poignant and perhaps life-changing events that happened in our most recent history. And of course, if we go back today, on the 12th of Cheshvan in 1995, it was the day that the then Prime Minister of Israel, Mr. Yitzhak Rabin, who had been the commander-in-chief of the IDF during the Six-Day War, it happened in a terrible, terrible event that he was assassinated on this date in 5756 or in 1995. Those of us who remember that far back will remember well the assassination, the shockwaves that it sent through the Jewish people around the world, and particularly for Israel, the terrible rift that had developed and then was created about what were then known as right-wing people in Israeli politics. It was an awful day and an awful event. And thereafter, of course, the funeral for the Prime Minister, for Yitzhak Rabin, for the Prime Minister of Israel, in Israel, which was attended by many from around the world, including a most famous individual by the name of President Bill Clinton, who was then the sitting president of the United States, who flew in for the occasion and had famously been involved in trying to make peace in Israel. Famous, poignant pictures of him, of Yitzhak Rabin, and Yasser Arafat, in peace moves that began all the way back then. It's only recently that former President Clinton has kind of mentioned, actually quite publicly, and in fact at a Democratic Party event, just what a failure all of those things were, how the other side were completely underestimated in what they actually wanted. He thought he had partners for peace, but in fact, there was only one side that really wanted to make peace. But be that as it may, Bill Clinton, if you remember correctly, made a powerful, powerful speech at the funeral of Yitzhak Rabin, bringing, of course, as he did, the well wishes, the good thoughts of comfort, of sympathy for Israel and for the family, from the people of the United States and around the world. And one of the phrases that he used there was the words Shalom Chaver. It became a slogan throughout Israel and around the world. It reverberated. It became one of those things that stuck in the collective memory of the Jewish people. Shalom Chaver, farewell, my friend. Peace on you, my friend, which was very, very well meant and very well intended, and a beautiful, beautiful note of comfort from the President of the United States to his chaver, to his friend, to his partner in peace, in Yitzhak Rabin. And on that occasion, or on the Shabbat that followed thereafter, that people around the world were unpacking what it was that had happened, what it was that Bill Clinton had actually said. I remember that he quoted from the Parsha of the Week as well. But this idea of Shalom Chaver was something that, in fact, stuck in my mind. And at the time, I spoke about personally in our own shul, which was then kind of just starting up. I spoke about the fact that Shalom Chaver can be taken as a great compliment. It can also be a little bit of an insult. If we think about it, it was always, or often a time, the mark of politics around the world, and particularly in the United States, that there were assassinations, political assassinations that had taken place, whether it was Abe Lincoln or it was Kennedy or others who were assassinated along the way. Terrible, terrible way to deal with political divisions, with trying to reach some kind of an agreement that you just get rid of the opponents. Terrible thought, terrible idea. And here, for the first time in such a public fashion, the Prime Minister of Israel was assassinated by a Jewish man, and it was something that was really awful for us to think about and to bear. Stuck in the throat, stuck in the guts, was a real punch to each and every one of us, that this was how politics was sorted. This was how politics happened around the world, but never in Israel. And the idea of Shalom Chaver could have been, in a cynical view, taken to mean Shalom Chaver, you're just like we are. You're now our friend. You now come to our level. You sort out your problems exactly the same way as we sort out ours. And therefore, to be thought about in that context, no compliment at all, but rather a bit of a dressing down, coming down to the level of the nations of the world, which is hardly the place and the space that the Jewish people need to be, ought to be, and we're destined to be. We're supposed to be that light unto the nations. We're supposed to be the ones who set the moral high ground. Aren't we so proud of the fact that it is our army that makes sure that they run by an ethical and a moral code, that there is a morality in what is done, that there is an adherence to what is always termed international law, although it's much more than that. It is the idea of the way that one needs to think about civilians, the way one needs to treat the dead, the way that one is meant to behave in all facets of our lives, let alone in a war kind of a situation. And certainly when it comes to politics, and when it comes to governance, and when it comes to democracy and so on, the same kind of moral behavior, the same kind of ethical behavior, and the same kind of godly, holy behavior is something that should be foremost in the minds and the hearts of everybody within Israel and Jews around the world, in how we react and how we behave. Just because the nations of the world go out and do certain things, just because everybody else is either corrupt or immoral or behaving in an inappropriate fashion, is not a license for us to actually imitate them. On the contrary, it is our job to show them the right way, to teach them the moral, ethical, holy way of behavior. This is something that we were empowered with. This is something that we were commanded to do. This is something that it actually means in our real vocab of what it means to be a Jew, to stand up for what is right, yes, to fight for what is right, yes, but not to do so in a way that we compromise our own morality, our own ethics, our own Torah standards. This is something we always need to adhere to. And unfortunately, the events of that assassination of Yitzhak Rabin on this day back in 1995 was something that seems to have abrogated all of those events. Now, if we go forward to tomorrow, the 13th of Cheshvan, something else amazing happened, which is in the history of the Jewish people on the 13th of Cheshvan. In 1553, we had the event called the burning of the Talmud in Venice. Now, this was by the order of the Pope. Talmud was burnt in Venice on the 13th and 14th of Cheshvan in 1553. And the reason given was that the Talmud contained statements that were heretical to the Christian faith. Venice boasted many famous Hebrew printing houses, including that of a Daniel Bomberg, who was an Italian Gentile, who published the Talmud during the years of 1519 to 1523. But then in 1553, by order of the Pope, Talmud was publicly burnt on the 13th and 14th of Cheshvan.
Get back to basics with Judaism 101 with Rabbi Michael Katz.
Now, this is not the only thing that these days are known for. And we've mentioned a few things that the 12th and 13th and the 14th of Cheshvan are known for in our history. The assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, amongst others. But also the 14th of Cheshvan was a day on which, in 1620, the Jews of Prague were saved. It happened in May 1618 that the Bohemian Revolt broke out in Prague, triggering what was known as the 30 Years' War. In November of 1620, King Ferdinand II, suppressed the rebels in Prague in the Battle of White Mountain. Notwithstanding the widespread looting, the king gave orders that no Jew should be harmed. To commemorate the miraculous turn of events, Reb Yom Tov Lipman Heller, who was the rabbi of Prague, instituted penitential prayers to be said every year on the 14th of Cheshvan, which he published in Prague later that year. So one good plus factor of salvation during this difficult time, 14th of Cheshvan. If we go to the 15th of Cheshvan, which is going to be this year on this coming Shabbos, there are a number of very important things that we commemorate on this coming Shabbos. First of all, it was the passing date of Matityahu, who had to do, of course, with the Hanukkah story. So it's kind of a month in advance notice, because it was Matityahu who was the father of the Maccabees, of Yehuda, Yochanan, Shimon, Elazar, and Yonasan, his sons. He passed away on this date in 139 before the Common Era. So going back over 2,000 years in the 2nd century before the Common Era, the Holy Land was ruled by the Seleucids, or the Syrian Greeks, who, with the collaboration of the Jewish Hellenists, introduced pagan idols into the Holy Temple and set about forcibly trying to Hellenize the people of Israel. Matityahu, the son of the high priest Yochanan, was already an old man when he picked up a sword and raised the flag of revolt in the village of Modi'in in the Judean hills. And many rallied under his cry, "Who is for God? Come with me," and resisted and battled the Greeks from their mountain hideouts. After heading the revolt for 1 year, he died on the 15th of Cheshvan in the year 3622 from creation, or 139 before the Common Era. His five sons, the Maccabees, Yehuda, Yochanan, Shimon, Elazar, and Yonasan, carried on the battle, eventually proclaiming their victory, which is celebrated every year with the Chag of Chanukah. But that's not the only thing that happened on this fateful day of the 15th of Cheshvan. We all watched with absolute horror what happened the other night after a football match in Amsterdam, and it was compared to an event that happened on the 15th of Cheshvan in 1938, and that was Kristallnacht. It was on the night, on this night in 1938, and it continued into the next day, which was then November the 9th on the second secular calendar, that the Nazis coordinated vicious pogroms against the Jewish community of Germany. They were encouraged by their leaders, and these rioters attacked and beat Jewish residents, burned and destroyed 267 shuls. They vandalized 7,500 businesses, which were owned by Jews, and they ransacked countless Jewish cemeteries, hospitals, schools, and homes. And the police and the firefighters just stood by and watched. 91 Jews were killed, and 20,000 others were then deported to concentration camps. And these pogroms, which became known as Kristallnacht, or the Night of Broken Glass, referring to the thousands of windows that were broken, were a turning point after which the Nazi Jewish policy intensified. So, terrible date, 15th of Cheshvan, goes down in our collective memory as the Day of Broken Glass, the Day of Kristallnacht. Now, something else happened, which is of a negative stance on this date, in around about 797, that the evil king Yeravam of Israel declared a holiday on this day, 1 month after Sukkot, where offerings were brought in his idolatrous temple. It's told about in 1 Kings 12 that this was part of his campaign to distance the people from the temple service, which took place in Jerusalem, which was ruled by Rehoboam, David's grandson. And as we mentioned before, he put up barricades and made sure that Jews did not travel to Jerusalem. And those barricades lasted for a long, long period of time until eventually they were lifted on the 15th day of Av in that year. If we go forward to the 16th of Cheshvan, Rabbi Shalom Dovber of Lubavitch left the town of Lubavitch. Now, this was in 1915. We know that the Chabad Hasidim had settled in a town called Lubavitch. They became known as the Lubavitcher Hasidim. Chabad being the philosophy, Lubavitch being the place, actually, that they came from, or that they were centered in for many, many years. But in 1915, Rabbi Shalom Dovber of Lubavitch left there, because there was the approach of the German army during World War I, and they were located then in Lubavitch, in a modern-day Russian city or town near the border of Belarus, and they traveled, him and his family and his Hasidim, to the city of Rostov. Lubavitch was the seat of the Chabad movement, in fact, for 102 years, starting with Reb Dovber, the second Chabad Rebbe, who settled there in 1813, and they stayed there, of course, until Rabbi Shalom Dovber of Lubavitch left in 1915. And now, finally, if we just look forward to the 17th of Cheshvan, we mentioned this actually last week, but it's coming up during this week, and that is on Monday, the 17th of Cheshvan, was the day in 2105 before the Common Era that the Great Flood began. The rains began to fall on the 17th of Cheshvan in the year 1656 from creation, or 2105, before the Common Era, flooding the earth and rising above the highest mountains. And it was only Noah and his family who survived, in an ark built to that end by divine command, and a pair of each animal species who entered with him into the ark. The following is actually a chronology of the flood, as indicated by the dates and time periods given in the Torah's account, and circulated, or calculated rather, by Rashi. It's the 17th of Cheshvan was the day on which Noah entered the ark, and the rains began on the 27th of Kislev. 40 days of rain end and begin 150 days of water swelling and churning, during which the water reaches a height of 15 cubits above the mountain peaks. That's quite high. On the 1st of Sivan, the water calmed and began to subside at a rate of 1 cubit every 4 days. On the 17th of Sivan, the bottom of the ark submerged 11 cubits beneath the surface, touched down on the top of Mount Ararat, and it was on the 1st of Av that the mountain peaks broke the water surface. And then on the 10th of Elul, 40 days after the mountain peaks became visible, Noach opens the ark's window and he dispatches the raven. It was on the 17th of Elul that Noach sent the dove for the first time there to go out and see if there was dry land. And on the 23rd of Elul, the dove goes out a second time, and that's the time it comes back with that eternal sign of peace with the olive leaf in its beak. On the 1st of Tishrei, it was the dove's third mission, and the water completely drained. And the 27th of Cheshvan, the ground was fully dried, and Noah exited the ark. So the total time that Noah spent in the ark was 365 days, one full solar year, 1 year and 11 days on the lunar calendar. Isn't that amazing? And in fact, the flood all began on the 17th of Cheshvan in 1656, 2105, before the Common Era. In other words, 4,500 years ago, roughly, that's the time that the flood began, and it all comes up and is commemorated in this coming week. So what do we do with all of these little bits of information in this or over this coming week? I think that we have there kind of a balance if we think about it. There are several dates that lead us to understand some good outcomes, or lead us to some good outcomes. There were some great events that happened along the way. But there was a lot of this kind of sad stuff, persecutions, difficulties, Kristallnacht, assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, and so on, things in more modern, more current history. And of course, kind of overshadowed right in the beginning by the idea of the flood. And we often look at these things in isolation, and they need to actually be placed on a timeline, on a chronological line, to take a look and to see just how often Jewish history actually repeats itself, how we keep on falling into the same traps, how we keep on living through the same kind of difficulties. We look at what happened over this past year with anti-Semitism. It's not our first rodeo. It's not the first time there's been anti-Semitism in the world. That's not encouraging. But what it does tell us is that we've been here before. We know what our job is, and we know how to actually triumph over it. We've got to be true to our faith. We've got to be true to what we believe in. We've got to be true to the truth. And we need to make sure that the world out there is never allowed to get the upper hand when it comes to things like anti-Semitism or the pursuit of evil, or allowing evil to manifest in whichever way possible, and not the least of which is, of course, what happened on October the 7th and what continues to happen throughout the world, where support is given to these dastardly kind of people who continue to propagate such terrible hatred and evil and warmongering and bloodshed and bloodthirstiness and the rest of it. It is something that we can never allow, tolerate, and we need to make sure and ensure that we as the Jewish people are living up to what is required from us, that we are keeping our Torah, that we're proud of who we are and where we come from, that we are never afraid to state the truth, and that we are always there to be counted as part of the Jewish people, part of the Jewish community, never, God forbid, turning our backs on our own people, never, God forbid, behaving like traitors, like we often see people who are encouraged through their own cowardice to turn to the other side. Nobody ever trusts a traitor, not from your side, not from the other side. And therefore, the need to actually stick to the truth, be proud of it, be proud of what it means to be Jewish, and to continue our path going forward to the coming of Mashiach, which we hope will arrive very, very soon in our time.
Get back to basics with Judaism 101 with Rabbi Michael Katz.
Hi, welcome back. Rabbi Michael Katz here with you in Judaism 101.9. Now, the Gemara in Tainis, the Talmud, tells us that there are three keys in God's hand which were not given to a messenger. If we take a look at the parshas that we're reading, and especially this parsha of Vayera, and of course it's not my job to talk about the parsha, but just a reference of the fact that angels were sent as messengers to bring about the miracle of Yitzchak's birth, to bring about the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah and so on. The Gemara in Tainis tells us that there are three keys in God's hand which were not given to a messenger. And they are the key of rain, the key of giving birth, and the key of the revival of the dead. We also have in Bereishis Rabbah, in the Midrash, that it says that the falling of rain is greater than the revival of the dead. The revival of the dead is only for man. Rain is for man and animal. The revival of the dead is for Israel, but rain is for Israel and all the nations of the world. We also have in the Gemara in Baba Basra the statement that many drops did I create in the clouds, but I created each drop different from all the others. For if any two drops were identical, the earth would not bring forth fruit. Statement by the Gemara, by the Talmud in Baba Basra. Now, though rain, through rain, everything is blessed. The conduct of business is blessed. The merchants profit, and even those who suffer from boils find respite. Even a precious stone is affected for the good. Its colors shine more brightly, and even fish are affected. Their weights increase. Three things are equal: earth, man, and rain. Without earth, there is no rain. Without rain, there is no earth. And without both, there is no man. This, of course, a quote from Bereishis Rabbah as well. And Vayikra Rabbah, another part of the Midrash says, "And I shall give you your rains in their proper time." Rabbi Yochanan said, three gifts were given to the world: the Torah, the luminaries, and rain in their proper times during the nights of Shabbos. In the days of Rabbi Shimon ben Shattach, rains fell on the Shabbos nights till the wheat and the barley grew to immense size, and they preserved them for later generations so that it might be known what the effects of sin are. And the sages have further said in the Gemara in Tainus, a day when rain falls is as great as the day when the Torah was given. A day when rain falls is as great as the day when heaven and earth were created. The rains fall if Israel's sins were forgiven, and great is the day of rain, for even a small coin in one's pocket is blessed by it. And it goes on to say the day of rain is as great as the day of the ingathering of the exiles. Now, we are told that this could be compared to a father who sends gifts to his son. As long as the gifts are few and he sends them with a messenger, he only gives his sons what he promised to give them. If he wishes to give them a large gift, he doesn't send it with a messenger, but he gives it himself. He calls his sons and opens his storehouse in order to give each one his intended gift. When the storehouse is open and they see all the treasures that are hidden there, the clever amongst them asks whatever their hearts desire, and their father gives it to them. For the treasure is open and the hour is an hour of goodwill. And so, likewise, all of God's kindnesses towards his creatures are done through his angels who carry out his mission without adding to it or diminishing from it. The gift of rain, however, God does not entrust to his messengers, lest they be unforgiving towards the transgressions of his creatures and withhold the rains, thus causing the world to become desolate. So the key of rain, therefore, remains in God's hands. And when he gives rain to the world, he gives it solely out of his treasure, without regard to strict judgment, reward, merit, but only with loving kindness, for he is all good. When the treasure is open, it's time of goodwill for Israel to ask all the good that their soul desires. And if at that time they ask of their Father in heaven that he might put the Torah into their hearts, as when the Father stood at Mount Sinai, he grants that request too. If they ask for salvation, for forgiveness, for sustenance, for the ingathering of the exiles, for the cessation of war from their midst, the time is one of goodwill for the granting of their requests, for all their requests are contained in the good treasure which God opens when the rains fall. And the Torah testifies to this in the book of Dvarim. May the Lord open for you his good treasure, the heavens, to give rain for your land in its time. And if you should say that good treasure is open only for the gift of rain, it isn't so, but rather, and to bless all the deeds of your hand. We learn from this how great is the chesed, the kindness of rainfall, how much devout intention one ought to have when we ask God for the blessing of the dew and the rain that we pray for at this time. And of course, thinking about the flood, the fact that it comes in its right time, as we've been having beautiful rainfall here in Joburg over the last few days, and when it comes in the way that it comes without creating a flood and wreaking havoc, it is God's rich brachas that he is showering upon us.
Get back to basics with Judaism 101 with Rabbi Michael Katz.
Welcome back. Great to be back with you. Apologies about that little frog in the throat. It is Rabbi Michael Katz on Judaism 101.9. Here just to sum up for today's session of Judaism 101.9. I guess with this thought, and that is that we are now in seriously far already into the month of Cheshvan, halfway through. Next month is the month of Kislev. We know that this was the month of what we described last week as Mar Cheshvan being the bitterness of Cheshvan, or as we say, the drop. There is so much that one can do with or learn from one little drop, as we did in our previous little chat about the rain. A drop of Tishrei should be and needs to be instituted into our daily lives in this month of Cheshvan. A drop of wisdom at a time when there is no wisdom, a drop of sincerity at a time when there is no sincerity, a drop of truth at a time when there is lies, or a drop of, or a little bit of light at a time that there is vast and huge darkness. It's all up to us to bring about this mar into the month of Cheshvan and make sure that the month of Cheshvan is in fact a time when we can truly ultimately celebrate, because as we mentioned last week, Cheshvan is a time when the building of the Beit HaMikdash came to its fruition, it came to its completion. It was only later dedicated, but actually we're told that this was kind of stuck away for the future, that in the future sometime there will be the grand celebration of the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash, or the temple in Yerushalayim. There will be the coming of Mashiach, and there will be the time when all these little drops of light, of wisdom, like the stars in the sky with which Avraham Avinu, with which Abram and his people, his future were actually blessed, that all of this will come together in a vast and beautiful light, in a vast and beautiful wellspring of the water of Torah, of mitzvahs, and so on, and that all of us will ultimately be able to go with the coming of Mashiach to a time of peace, of happiness, of goodness, of everything that is kind, that is right, and that is true in a world that seems to be a little bit confused about a number of those features. So I want to wish you a great rest of the week, a great Shabbat up ahead. Remember, it is the Shabbos of the Shabbos Project. Yes, and make sure that you are in there and you're keeping Shabbos and you're doing all the things that you and your community and your shul and your environment are going to be putting on for this very, very special Shabbos. The Shabbos of the Shabbos Project, something that South Africa is so proud of, that we've taught the world of Judaism of late, and hopefully it'll be a Shabbos of Kodesh, Shabbat Kodesh, a beautiful holy Shabbos, a Shabbos of Menucha, a Shabbos of rest, a Shabbos of Shalom, a Shabbos of peace, and please God, a great Shabbos to herald all the other Shabbatot, the other Shabboses coming in the future, and please God, a time when it'll be a Yom Shekula Shabbos, a time that the whole world will be clothed in and cloaked in the Shabbos of the coming of Mashiach. Have a great rest of the week, a great Shabbos, and look forward to chatting to you again next week, same time, same place, on Judaism 101.9.